Welcome everyone to Creating a Family, Talk About Infertility. Today we're going to be talking about infertility advocacy. If we want treatment for this disease to be available to as many people as possible, we all need to be advocates, or at the very least, we need to understand where the threats lie. This is an important show. I am so glad you're tuning in. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear.
We now have, six states that have insurance for fertility preservation. And my colleagues are in Texas today and tomorrow advocating in Texas for fertility preservation of all places. So why not? This should get done.
This show is brought to you by Creating a Family. We are the National Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit. I'm Dawn Davenport. I'm your host. I'm also the director of Creating a Family. And you can find us and all of our resources online at creatingfamily.org. Our show is underwritten by Ferring Pharmaceutical, and they want you to know about an app called Ferticom. It is for any phone, and it's developed by reproductive psychologists Dr. Ali Domar and Dr. Liz Grill. It was designed specifically to help women address the many challenging emotional life situations that arise while struggling to conceive. They use cognitive behavior as well as relaxation techniques, and they cover over 50 specific situations. It is a great app. It's free. You can get it at ferticomapp.com. That's ferticomapp.com. Today is our annual Infertility Advocacy Show, where we talk about all things related to the availability of treatment of the disease of infertility. We are happy to have back Sean Tipton. He is the Chief Advocacy, Policy, and Development Officer for the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, as well as Bob Kalura. She is the Executive Director of Resolve, who are the National Infertility Association. Barb and Sean, welcome back to Creating a Family. We're so glad to have you back.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks, Dawn. Well, it's good to be with you.
All right, let's start with, we need to put in a plug for Advocacy Day. We're going to do it again at the end, but I want everybody to get their calendars out, because if you care about infertility and the availability of infertility, this is something you need to have on your calendar. And so, Barb, tell us quickly the date for advocacy, as well as the time. The Advocacy Day, I'm sorry.
Advocacy Day is in Washington, D.C. It'll be May 15th and May 16th. On May 15th, if you have never been to Advocacy Day before, we'll have a new advocate training from 2:30 to 4:30, so you'll need to get to Washington by 2:30. We have a welcome reception for everyone from 5 until 7 p.m., and that's all on May 15th. You will spend the night in Washington. We start very early on May 16th. And we start with a training, which is about a two-hour training from 8 to 10 a.m. And we'll have guest speakers, and you'll get yourself all situated for the day. And then from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., you'll be on Capitol Hill in your scheduled meetings and other impromptu meetings that you will have with your U.S. senators and your representative. You will not be alone. You'll be grouped with people from your state, and you will have an opportunity to share your infertility or family building story and to advocate for not only infertility in general, but actual bills that are in the U.S. Congress that will help our community. So we need everybody there. This is not just for people currently on their journey. It's for anyone that cares about family building. We have about half the people there are actually professionals in this space, and the other half are people who've gone through infertility, who are still on their journey, and their friends and family.
Great. Thank you. All right. May 15th and 16th. I am sure that everybody has now written it on your calendar. All right. I am so excited to say that we get to start today with a massive win. It just happened. So, in fact, Barb was telling before the show began that it has been a whirlwind of work, and that I don't know if you're celebrating or just trying to relax and get your life back after all this happened, but quickly tell us about what is the win, Barb, and then, Sean, I promise we're going to get you in here too, but, let me start with Barb on the big win in New York.
Yeah, this is fantastic, Dawn. And it is, you know, when we scheduled this interview, you never know what's going to be happening. It's funny because I thought to myself that we probably would have a lot of information on what's going on at the state level when we scheduled this interview. But I really never, ever would have expected that we'd be talking about being basically done in New York. So what has happened is the state of New York, as of March 31st, passed a bill that requires large employers in the state of New York, and I can give you exactly who it covers, requires them to offer three cycles of IVF to their employees. And it also requires that all plans in the commercial market, so that's large plans, small group plans, as well as individual plans, provide insurance coverage for medically necessary fertility preservation. So we now have about 2 million New Yorkers, Dawn, that'll get access to IVF, and we have about 4 million New Yorkers that'll get access to fertility preservation.
And we now can say, we've been saying for, it feels like years, that we have 15 states that have a mandate for insurance, and now we can say we have 16.
Yeah, and that number's a little deceiving because it's actually the 15 states, some of those included states that just mm-hmm. have what's called a mandate to offer, like California. So mm-hmm. I've always qualified it by saying there was only 8 states that covered IVF, and then we added Delaware. So for the last 9 months, we've been saying 9 states. Now we can say 10 states.
Oh, that's exciting. Okay, yeah, it's a good way to put it. So we have 10 states that cover some number of IVF.
Yes.
And the others have various, there is something in their law that requires coverage or requires that companies of a certain size offer that this plan is one that they can offer. But 10 now, yeah, you're right. We really should qualify that more. It's actually a good point. Well, yay, good work. Sean, I know ASRM has been very involved with this as well. So congratulations to you and Resolve for the huge amount of work y'all have put in.
Yeah, thank you. It was an interesting situation in New York, and it shows you the power of elections. There was an election in the fall, which created a more favorable environment for this to pass in New York. And, you know, in all the states work a little differently. And in New York, we were able to get this in a budget bill, which got it done more quickly than we had anticipated. So it's quite a win and exciting sense of momentum for the whole community.
Hey, Sean, you may not know this, and that's fair. Do you have a feel for what percentage of people in the U.S. have health insurance coverage for, and this is, Barb raises a good question. I was going to say for infertility diagnosis or treatment, but I also would like to know what percentage have coverage for IVF, because that would include people both within states that require it, but also those who work for companies who offer it, even though it isn't required. Do you have any feel for that?
It's quite difficult to answer that question with any precision. You know, one thing that's important to keep in mind is that all these state mandates have huge exemptions on either end of the employment scale. So people who work for large multi-state employers, state regulation of insurance doesn't touch them. So if you're working for Walmart or Ford Motor Company, there is a federal law that precludes states from regulating that insurance coverage for you. And most of them have an exemption at the other end for small employers as well. So when you say a state has passed a mandate, it's important to understand that mandate doesn't touch everybody. And of course, it only applies to people who already have health insurance, which leaves a huge number of people in this country out of the picture altogether.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And we just, at Resolve, we're actually drafting a blog post, and it goes through the details of the New York legislation. And we specifically put a section in there that says who this does not cover. Because mm-hmm. so often when you look at these mandates, Dawn, you know, everyone goes, oh, what's the coverage? And I actually got a phone call from a woman yesterday. She got the email. She heard about the news. I don't know who she is. She literally just like found our phone number on our website, and she has individual insurance, and she said, when can I start getting my IVFs? And I'm like, oh, you're not covered, you know? So, and even people like who work for the federal government, but live in New York, they're confused. So we like, I hate to say it, but we have a whole paragraph on who is not covered.
And when will that blog be up?
Hopefully in the next couple of days. Okay. Because
and that website, everybody, is resolve.org. And so you go there and let's see.
Well,
you'll see their
we'll
blog.
Figure we'll figure it out. You'll figure it out once you get to the website. But it is you know, that's why I said the numbers, because it is a significant win. But as Sean said, you know, state laws, when these state legislatures pass state laws, it's so exciting, and it's a ton of work, and it does impact a lot of people, but there's a lot of people that it does not impact. So we can't like stop. We can't stop fighting and doing what we're doing.
And I think, Dawn, what we know is that for clinics who are in states with strong insurance mandates, you know, it's still something around half, give or take 10% on either side, of their patient volume that is paid for by insurance. So it touches people. And what we know is that not only does it apply to certain people who meet the legal requirements, it tends to change the market in those states.
Yeah.
So that people who are not necessarily legally required to cover anyway, because word gets out amongst the employers and in the insurance companies, they figure out how to offer this benefit and figure out it doesn't, in fact, make them go broke.
Yeah.
And they got to be competitive.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're not offering it, then right.
The labor pool, if the labor pool can choose where they want to go work, and some companies offer it and some don't, you know, they're going to vote with their feet. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Sean, I'm giving you all the hard ones right now. So why infertility is a disease? Why is it not covered? I mean, just across the board, why are we having to fight state by state to get coverage for this disease?
Well, how much time we have? I can talk about this for 8 or 10 hours probably, but I think the short answer is we have a long, shameful history around reproductive medicine and reproduction and sexuality in general in this country. And insurance companies are happy to take advantage of that stigma in order to avoid paying for something. I mean, I think it's as simple as that. You know, it's absolutely shameful. I don't understand why this has happened. I mean, it's hard to imagine an insurance company saying, well, yeah, I'm not really going to cover heart disease. I don't approve of it, but I think it's wrapped up in a great many societal things that make it easy for folks to avoid.
And probably a more apt one would be, oh, if you've got heart disease, it's not fatal. I mean, it doesn't look like it's going to kill you. Because that's what we hear too, is that, well, infertility is really, you know, it's not like it's a disease and that you're going to die. And that one drives me crazy. But in fact, that's what we do
here. Well, and to that point, and I totally agree with Sean. And so given what Sean just stated, then I would look to the community to advocate for that change. You know, I look at how mastectomies are completely covered after, reconstructive surgery is completely covered after a mastectomy. And that is not life-saving. Mm-hmm. You know, that's definitely life-enhancing. And for any of us who know people who've gone through that, it is very involved and very expensive and takes a very long time. So it's probably more expensive than a couple of IVF cycles. But that is covered. That reconstructive surgery is covered because of advocacy, because the breast cancer community, the physicians rose up and said, this should be covered. And they got it covered. And so, you know, so how can we take what Sean said is this long history and now raise our voices to bring about a different way of looking at it and change. So I think we have some good examples where there's been success.
Yeah. And as we've got some proof now, we're already up to 10 states that cover IVF. Of the 10 states that cover IVF, do they all cover it the same way? Do they cover, you said New York covers three IVF cycles. Others sometimes have a lifetime limit. Is there any uniformity of what states are offering and what all of us infertility advocates are advocating for? Or is it pretty much just whatever, the Wild West as to whatever the state's going to have?
You want me to answer that, Sean?
Oh, yeah, it's a good question.
It's a good segue for Sean. No, there is no uniformity. And we, this is a big problem because one of the things that is kind of missing is this, and this is because IVF is a really, as you know, a very involved medical procedure. It's been very difficult to come up with a standard of care, kind of one size fits all. Here's what mm-hmm. it looks like. And you hand that over to a legislator and you say, this is what the coverage looks like. So what has happened is each state, there's been different people involved, different drafters of legislation. Some states I could, you know, I don't want to take up the whole hour, but in some states, things got put in to the insurance bills by legislators, like in the middle of the night, that didn't even make sense from a medical standpoint. And so when you leave it up to legislators, that sometimes happens. But we don't have a uniform approach to looking at this. And I think that's something that we as a community still need, and it needs to be evidence-based. It needs to be locked down, and physicians totally agree with that. And because what's happening, Dawn, is the insurers are making up a lot of this, and they are they are designing a benefit plan and a benefit coverage that we all look at and go, oh, it doesn't make sense at all. So if we're going to go in mm-hmm. with legislation, it needs to be really solid and medically based, and that's definitely not always the case. Sean, what do you?
Yeah, I'll give an example of that, and then I will turn that over to Sean. An example of that is there, and I don't know what the new law in New York, but there are still states and insurance companies that are offering policies, even if it's not required by the state, that require a certain number of intrauterine inseminations, IUIs, before moving to IVF. And sometimes that is actually what a doctor would, that is the smart approach, but often it isn't. There's actually some really good research that would indicate that the cheapest and fastest way towards a pregnancy in many cases is to move straight to IVF, and it actually saves money and it saves time, which is important in protecting fertility. So that's an example where an insurance company is prescribing something that really is no longer considered best practice medically. Sean?
Well, and that's one of the risks. I mean, one of the reasons for the variation between the states is a time factor. So when these mandates are passed, and the technology in the mid-90s was very different than what we're dealing with today.
Very true.
So that's one of the dangers, in fact, of putting too much specificity into these statutes, because you were locking in something that works now that may not be the right way to proceed in 5 years. And the example you decided is a good one. You know, used to be, we thought you should take people through inseminations first. And now we know that's not always the case. So to be blunt, we would much rather not have to pursue legislation to get insurance coverage. We would like it much better if infertility were treated like every other disease. And that is, if you have health insurance, your health insurer takes care of you. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that has not been the case. So we're kind of forced to go this policy route. But that's one of the downsides to the policy route, is it becomes difficult to keep up with the growing technology.
And it allows for a lot of misinformation and miscommunication, and quite frankly, just ignorance and of people not understanding the process. I'd ask you the question of how many people were insured. Sean, do you have a feel for it? It seems to me, and I have read some, but I haven't gotten any good statistics on this, that more companies are, even companies that are not in states that require it, are offering insurance coverage in their benefits package. Undoubtedly, for the reasons wanting to be competitive in the hiring market, or maybe just compassion. Do you have a? Am I right that more companies are offering benefits, Sean?
I think it's hard to say that for sure. You see some high profile additions, and you read about those. You know, you're much less likely to hear about somebody who drops it. I don't know mm-hmm. that I've ever heard of that. But it's not to say it doesn't happen. So I do think the tide is turning. I think the kind of work we're doing in public education and the kind of work you do for education around these advocacy efforts, I think that has an impact. We talked about how passing the bill can change the marketplace. I think sometimes just the debate can change the marketplace as well. And mm-hmm. of course, what we know, maybe Barb will talk about this a little, is that quite often employers just don't understand that they're not offering this. So sometimes it can be a simple thing to say, hey, maybe mm-hmm. we should have this benefit. And people say, well, yeah, we should. Let's do it. So again, policy route is not our first option. It's just one that sometimes you have to resort to.
Well, that's a great segue into the question of most companies that offer, who have not been offering it and start offering coverage for infertility, do so because an employee brought it up and asked them. So Barb, how do people go about asking and who do they ask and are they ever effective?
So let's just pause for a moment. And the state laws that like the one in New York that we just passed, they impact what's called the fully insured marketplace. And those are tend to be small companies and large companies of 100 employees, maybe up to 500 employees, maybe even a little bit less. When you get a company that has over 500 employees and certainly over 1,000 employees, they are, and data shows about over 90% of those kinds of companies are what's called self-insured or self-funded. And so you as an employee having benefits, you don't know if your company is fully insured or self-insured. It doesn't say that anywhere. But the general rule is if you're working for a company that's got, you know, over 1,000 employees, definitely, you know, is probably going to be self-insured. And so what I'm going to talk about is that bucket of companies, because what happens with a self-insured company is that the company has full say in what their benefits are going to look like. They can basically create whatever they want, whatever kind of coverage they want. And so as an employee, guess what? You have a tremendous say in that process. And so we have a program called Coverage at Work, and our whole goal, Dawn, is to motivate employees at self-insured companies to go in and advocate for coverage. So just like they would go to their state legislator or they might come to Washington to advocate, we're basically saying, okay, take those skills and now go down to your HR department, go to your benefits administrator. So we have a template letter that helps get that conversation started. You would insert your personal story into that, and providing that to your benefits department at your company. Now, I get it. That's going to take a lot of guts for you to go down to your employer and say, hi, I'm infertile, and I would love to have, you know, this company provide IVF. But that's what's happening. People are having to speak up and having to share that. Because if nobody is telling the HR folks or the benefit folks that this matters, Dawn, they're not going to add it. And so when we hear about companies adding it, they'll say, oh, well, we did an employee survey about, you know, what benefits they want, and we want to be family friendly, and IVF came up as, you know, in the survey. Okay, great. But what if you didn't have a survey? How are you letting people know? In fact, Dawn, we went to insurers and we said, why in the self-insured market, why isn't this more widely offered? What are you guys doing that's preventing that? And they said, hey, it's not us. Our customers who are employers aren't asking for it. And guess what? The companies aren't asking for it because their employees aren't asking for it. So I like to take kind of the bottom-up approach, and I want employees advocating and making their employers a little, you know, uncomfortable and saying, gee, we have a lot of employees that want this. They're going to turn around and say to their self-insured health insurance plan, you know what? My employees really need this. Can you add IVF coverage? So that's how the process works. So we have a template letter. You can go in and tell your story. We also have a white paper that you can give your HR folks that is for a benefits person. It's written for a benefits person. We have a really cool infographic on why having coverage is good for your employees. So we have some tools, but the folks have to go in and be our feet on the ground and start that conversation.
Yeah, but you make it fairly easy.
And Barb just said something that I think is real important, and that is the bottom-up aspect of this, because we spent years thinking, oh, we're the smart doctors. We know how to talk about this, and we would try to, and we still do, go and have conversations with insurance companies directly and employers directly. And I've been pretty impressed that empowering employees to ask seems to be much more effective than having our folks go in and try to make the case sort of on a medical financial basis.
I was just in Sacramento last week. We were advocating for legislation in California. And one of our advocates works for a self-insured food company. And she made the ask. And now they're going to offer 3 cycles of IVF starting like June 1st or something. She goes, yeah, I went in, I made the ask. They did a bunch of research and it's done. And it's going to impact like 5,000 employees or something like that. I was like, oh my gosh. So it's dawn. It's so cool when it happens.
When you see the fruits of your work and you see, you know, it's not just affecting this woman. It's affecting everyone. Let me pause here to remind you that you're listening to Creating a Family. And today we're talking about infertility advocacy. And we're talking with Barb Calora and Sean Tipton. Let me remind you that this show would not happen without the generous support of our partners who believe in our mission of providing unbiased, medically accurate information to the patient community. One such partner is Cryos International Sperm and Egg Bank. They are dedicated to providing a wide range and selection of high-quality, extensively screened frozen donor sperm and egg for all races, ethnicities, and phenotypes, for both home insemination and fertility treatment. Cryos International is the world's largest sperm bank and the first freestanding independent egg bank in the United States, helping to provide a wonderful gift to families. And let me also throw out a request to everyone. Please pop over to iTunes and give this show a rating. We depend upon that because iTunes depends upon the rating. So we read each one if you write a comment, and we appreciate that, but we will just take the star rating as well. So if you will pop over there and do that, that would be a huge help to us. All right. Now, coming back, we've talked about insurance. Now let's talk to one that's in some ways more insidious, and that is the whole idea of personhood laws. Sean, can you explain what we mean by personhood laws?
Sure. The concept is these are measures either federally or in state to either put in through statute or in some cases through the Constitution, a measure that says that a fertilized egg has full constitutional and legal standing in that jurisdiction, be it the state or the country in the case of the federal government. So it is these are pushed by anti-abortion activists. It has a long history that has to do with some of the language in the Roe v. Wade decision itself, which is the Supreme Court case that legalized abortion throughout the country. And it's an attempt to stop abortion. Now, the problem is, depending on how these things are worded, they can have a very detrimental impact on infertility treatments, specifically dealing with, because it could make it difficult or impossible to do things like that are very common, like freeze your embryo, or they take away the patient's dispositional control over their own reproductive tissue. So they're kind of scary and they can be kind of sneaky. And when the so far, when the battles have been fought out in public and worth any length of time, we have always won them. So we've won them at the ballot box multiple times in Colorado and in Mississippi, and we've won in a number of legislative – we've won a number of state legislative battles over the years. But they're still coming, and sometimes they get sneaky. So we just this week are dealing with one in Iowa that started as one of these fetal homicide statutes. That is the idea that if you were to if you kill a woman who was also pregnant, you have committed two homicides. So it started with that, and now it has been amended to becoming, in effect, a personhood statute. So we're having to gin up late in the day to try to fight it. And it, I don't know how we'll do there, frankly.
Sean, how are some of the, what are some of the ways that these laws impact in a very practical way the practice of infertility medicine?
Well, it's hard to generalize because it's depends on the very specific wording of the measure you're talking about in the state, and they can differ. But for example, if they just say that life begins at the moment of conception, and from that moment on, you have full constitutional and legal standing in the state, for example, which is a common sort of way to do these. What that means is that a fertilized egg in an IVF facility's laboratory is to be treated just like any other living person. So, you know, you can't freeze an adult or a born baby. We do that all the time with embryos. So, you know, it creates a lot of issues. For example, if an embryologist were to trip and fall and spill a vial that had embryos in it, under personhood measures, that medical professional has just committed a homicide. So, you know, it's pretty scary to think about in real life how that might work for infertility patients and professionals.
It would also impact people who have embryos remaining after they finish their family building, because it in what I guess it depends on how the law is written, but it may preclude them from any options other than donating to another family or perpetual cryopreservation.
Well, I'm not even sure that perpetual cryopreservation would be allowed. I mean, again, you know, when I was growing up, I would have loved to have put my big brother in a freezer. You know, it would have been frowned upon. Had my big brother still been a four-celled embryo, probably would have been okay.
Well, okay, yeah, valid point. Barb, so what can the rest of us do other than be aware of how these type of laws impact the practice of infertility medicine as well as the availability of it?
Well, I think there's two ways that I always approach this. And one is, first of all, and I think, Sean, you would agree with me, but we never say personhood would outlaw IVF. I should say resolve. We don't necessarily say it that way. As Sean has described, we always say that it would make the practice of IVF to the standard of care that we all deserve and that is delivered very, very difficult. So that's a little different way than saying it's outlawed. Outlawed, you think that, like, you know, people are going to arrest an embryologist or something. So the other thing is I tell people that even if they have identified themselves as pro-life on the choice, anti-choice spectrum, that personhood is an extreme anti-choice position. I say extreme because it is not something that has really that has taken hold in terms of past, and that is, you know, a real strategy. We're certainly worried that may happen, but thus far it has not been a mainstream anti-choice method. And so when you are thinking about a state legislator or a federal legislator and you're looking at their record on the choice issue and anti-choice issue, don't assume that they're going to necessarily support personhood. We have found over the years that once we sit down with these folks and we explain how personhood would negatively impact the practice of IVF, they are astounded. They had no idea. You know, we are educating them. They feel, oh my gosh, that's gone too far. That's not what I'm trying to do here. So it's been really eye-opening to me to take that education, but it takes time. And people don't know when they look at a bill that's two or three sentences long. And a lot of these personhood bills are very short and look very to the point. And then when we come in and we say, but this is what's going to happen to people who are trying to build their family, they're really surprised, quite honestly. So those are just a couple of things to take away from this is that it's subtle. It can sometimes be subtle, and there's an education and a communication around this that the onus is on us and our community to do. Sean can tell you, you know, we can't stay silent. We can't assume that anybody's going to understand and know where we're coming from in our position. And that makes it even harder and scarier for us because we got to show up, because every single one of these, we got to start over and explain the whole thing.
Yeah, that makes very good sense. All right, let's now talk about surrogacy and surrogacy laws. Talk about variations. It really does differ by state. So how do the states vary, Barb, in their laws on surrogacy?
Well, the vast majority of states have no law. And so what is the norm is based on either case law or just, you know, the general practice. There are very, very few states that have good statutes that talk about surrogacy and ensure that it is legal and that protections are in place. And I can name a few of those states that have done that. And then we have states like New York and Michigan that gestational surrogacy is very, very difficult. In fact, in New York, compensated gestational carrier arrangements are actually illegal. So you've got the real spectrum. And then, like I said, the vast majority do not have any kind of law. And so, you know, there's, you know, for the most part, very good things that are happening in those states, but the potential is there. Without any kind of good regulation to ensure that nothing bad happens.
Oh, okay. So I see your point. Then the absence of laws could be detrimental, because the laws also make certain that everything happens in a manner that is in the best interest of all parties.
Well, we have a situation in Minnesota right now where they're trying to make gestational surrogacy very, very difficult. And if we had had a law, a good piece of regulation, which the state had actually and advocates had actually advocated for a number of years ago, that was then vetoed, you know, we wouldn't be in this position. So, you know, in Maryland, a group of ART attorneys and physicians and Resolve have worked really hard on a good piece of legislation in the state of Maryland, not because anything bad's happened in Maryland, but it just is the right thing to do. And it has really, that has stalled in Maryland. So some states are more open to it. And then, you know, we want to fend off anything that could pop up that's negative. In the case of New York, we're working very hard to overturn that ban. And so we have a really good piece of legislation that we're trying to get passed, and knock on wood, it'll happen before June. But can you imagine here, the state of New York, you can't do a compensated gestational surrogacy arrangement at all.
Are there any other states where it is illegal, Barb?
So Michigan has, I believe Michigan is also illegal, but I don't want to be quoted on that.
Michigan, I think, is actually a little stricter even than New York. So I think the act in Michigan is illegal, as opposed to lack of a binding contract.
In New York, it's only if it's compensated, I believe.
No. Well, that's the case for Michigan too, but it has to do with, is the contract enforceable or is the act illegal?
Right. Okay. So you can, even in New York, if it's you know, a compassionate surrogacy, you still can't have a contract, and you still can't, you know, do any, you can't even help pay for rent if they're on bed rest or anything like that. So it is, it's, you know, it's not good.
And so those are the two big states that come to mind, because most states are simply silent when it comes to surrogacy. Yeah.
Correct.
And, you know, I have to say here, Barbara's talking about the Maryland case, you know, things work okay for people doing gestational surrogacy in Maryland. So I get a little nervous sometimes when we try to change that and get a much better statute in. Now Maryland is a little different of a state, but in some states you start that process and it's easy to lose control of it, and you could end up with something bad. So, you know, my general inclination is, if the case law is good and a process is working for people, let's leave it alone.
You know, and Sean, you've said that so many times, and I always have that in the back of my head. You know, it's Sean Tipton says, and it's so true. And you also have a really great saying, being from Kentucky. You know, it's about who brought you to the dance. Do you want to say that one?
Well, I can do my whole Southern political euphemisms talk, but you know, in this case, one of them would be, let sleeping dogs lie. So if nothing is happening bad, don't try to change it. But the concern really is, you can be well-intentioned. You can get a good member of the legislature who wants to help you, and they might not have the power to see it all the way through. And somebody could slip something bad in at the end, and you could end up in a bad place. So I really think you got to be careful there.
Yeah. So, and not to belabor that point, but that has happened, Dawn. And, if you know, you have a great bill and then it gets mucked up in some mm-hmm. committee, and all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, we can't support this. And you want to make sure that your bill sponsor is somebody who you know well, but as Sean said, has the power to basically kill their own bill, because, you know, now the train has left the station and they mm-hmm. have to stop it. And that's the danger of legislation, period. And so you've got to walk into it, as Sean said, with knowing who your supporters are, but also just feeling like you have a lot of control, because there's so many places in that journey of that bill going through the legislative process where it can get totally lost.
Well, we'll end on another Southern euphemism. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. So, yeah, so that's what we'll do. We'll say, so that's kind of the status of where we stand with surrogacy. And for those in our audience who are thinking about surrogacy, it is really important to get with an infertility or a reproductive law specialist, an ART lawyer. And we have resources on our site for how to find one. But that's the person who can help you figure out how to approach it and where you live. And it's important to know that each state has separate laws, so you really do have to have an attorney. And I say this so much, I have a text expander for it. But it needs to be an attorney that specializes in reproductive law. And that is not the same thing as family law. Now, it can be, but there are two different specialties. And so you really do need to find somebody who is up to date on what the law is in your state, and how to protect you and your future child and the surrogate. All right, now let's talk about fertility preservation for people who are undergoing some type of medical treatment. We always think of chemo, but there are other forms of medical treatment that will impact a person's fertility. The best practice is for them to have fertility preservations. If it is a man, to have his sperm frozen, and if it is a woman, to have her eggs removed and frozen to give them fertility options in the future. Now, Barb, I'm assuming that any caring person would think that somebody undergoing medical treatment that's going to rob them of their fertility, that fertility preservation would just automatically be covered. Tell me I'm right.
Oh, Dawn, no. Didn't you hear anything Sean said? This whole thing of sperm and egg and reproduction, nobody likes to talk about that and cover it and even acknowledge that
our
bodies have these parts that, you know, can do things. Yeah. So it is really unbelievable that this is not part of cancer care, that this is not, this is not infertility. Okay. This is fertility, medically necessary fertility preservation is not infertility. And that's the problem, is that people look at an infertility definition in a state and say, well, you have to be infertile. You have to have tried for 12 months. And the person's like, I'm 22 or I'm 18 or I just got diagnosed with Hodgkin's and I have 2 weeks before I start my treatment. This has nothing to do with I'm trying to conceive. So this is about future fertility and how that, and this is what we call iatrogenic. This word iatrogenic means medically induced, meaning a medical procedure, a surgery, a drug, something that is going to be done to your body is going to cause your infertility or impair your future fertility. And so, this could be even transgender medication that you're taking. This could be surgery for endometriosis. This could be radiation, as we've mentioned. So, we want to make sure that that is covered by insurance. And, the example you used of cancer patients is the one that most of us all think about. And, here's the thing. Good news is people are surviving their cancer diagnoses at a young age. The survivorship is actually very high. And studies show that when they ask these young men and women, what are the important things to you when you think about survivorship? It's parenthood. It's like number one. Will I ever be a parent? We had a gal, a 25-year-old woman at our advocacy day in New York last year. She was diagnosed with cancer when she was 18. And her dad had the foresight to say to the oncologist, hey, will my daughter ever be able to have kids? I mean, she was 18. She wasn't thinking about it, but her dad was. And she was able to freeze her eggs. So her parents paid for it. But so we've been advocating for insurance coverage for that. And as Sean said, we don't like going to the legislative route at all. Nobody relishes this, but we're doing it. And we now have, 6 states that have insurance for fertility preservation. And my colleagues are in Texas today and tomorrow advocating in Texas for fertility preservation of all places. So why not? This should get done. This is such a no-brainer, Dawn. This is
such
a no-brainer.
Yeah, just plain kind. These people don't have, these decisions are having to be made in a very short period of time because they're being treated for cancer. And so, take your time, figure this thing out, try for a while. And they're not ready, and actually wouldn't be smart for them to be having children right now. They've got a life-threatening disease.
And they're, the oncologists are in a hurry to start treatment, and the patients are in a hurry to start treatment, and they don't have the time to fight with insurance bureaucrats and do all, you don't have time for an appeals process when your claim is denied.
Exactly.
In this situation. So, again, sometimes the only thing to do is to pursue a legislative mandate for it.
Yeah, that way everybody is protected, and it's not the poor person, the man or the woman, who is facing a life-altering diagnosis at the same time they want to preserve their fertility for their future life. Yeah, that's why this just seems so cruel to put somebody in. I just can't imagine how difficult that time must be for someone, and then to put them in a position where they're now having to fight and try to figure out how to pay for something that they're hoping that they're going to get cured and be able to use their gametes. All right, let's talk a little about, and actually this is a little bit of overlap, how the military handles coverage for infertility treatment for their soldiers or families. And Sean, the overlap is that sometimes it's their service that has impacted their fertility. Sometimes it's not. But so let's talk about both, how the military handles the infertility just in general.
Well, of course, the biggest overlap is that it's another inexcusable, unethical omission that, for the most part, our military and our veterans do not get their reproductive medical needs taken care of appropriately by our government. So That's, I think, the key overlap. Now, there are some, we are making some progress on that front. So if you are both active duty and for veterans, if your infertility was caused directly through a service-related injury, you can now get your infertility covered. Now, that seems to be working a little bit better under TRICARE, the system that takes care of active duty military. It's still a little bit of a struggle in the Veterans Administration system, but you know, we're hard at work working with them, working with the appropriate oversight committees in Congress to try to help encourage the VA to get to figure out how to do all this better. So we're making some progress, but again, it is currently limited to those who have been rendered infertile through their service. And that really needs to change.
So what about a spouse of, or a military, a soldier herself who is infertile, but not through injury caused by her service to our country? How does TRICARE handle that, Sean?
They wish you good luck and send you on your merry way.
Yeah, so they don't have coverage, Dawn. TRICARE does not cover IVF. So that's about 9 million. I think TRICARE is about 9 million lives. That's active duty and retirees that don't have coverage for IVF. But what the military does is there's a handful of what they call military treatment facilities, which are basically hospitals or medical facilities run by the military. And there's, you know, they're all over the country, but there's a handful of them, five or six of them, let's say, that actually do IVF. And one of them is Walter Reed, that's here in Washington, D.C. You know, one's in San Diego, one's in outside of Seattle. So what happens is you as somebody who's active duty, think about it. You have to get yourself to one of those military treatment facilities. You're paying for it out of your own pocket. You're going to have to pay for, you know, you're going to have to take leave or something because it's not like it's part of your job. And then you're going to pay out of pocket. Now, the good news is the doctor and the facility is covered, is paid for by the military because it's at these military treatment facilities. So you're paying about half the cost. Most of that is the lab and your medications because the labs are not military run. So all of the work that the lab does is done by a third party that the military has contracted with, and so you're still forking out $5,000-$7,000 or more. Plus, you have to get yourself there, and you got to figure out how you're going to take leave. So, and these are, you know, our military is all over the world. So, you know, you got to be here in the U.S. It's very hard. It's so many barriers. So if you're in a city, if you're stationed someplace where there's, you know, access to ASRM's members, you're paying like everybody else. Mm-hmm. You don't get any kind of deal, and you don't get insurance. Your TRICARE doesn't cover it.
And the other thing that we hear from military is that there's often, if you are fortunate enough to be located near one of the military hospitals that offer our facilities that offer IVF. And as you point out, there's only five, so there's not very many, and the odds are not high. But let's say you are located, there's usually quite a bit of a wait time before you can get treatment. And time is just not often, it's not on your side usually because you're postponing your in every year that goes by. You decrease your chances with or without treatment. And I'm not sure that that's universal to all the facilities, but we have certainly heard that complaint.
Yeah, it's definitely a problem at some of the facilities. Certainly, I think the one in California is one of the ones you always hear about. Walter Reed generally is, there's not a big wait time, which is kind of surprising, but it can handle a larger volume. And so, so they tend to do a better job of that. But I'll tell you, it's unacceptable, as Sean said. And we have a bill in Congress that we'll be advocating for at our advocacy day that would require TRICARE to cover it.
Okay, excellent. All right. I was checking on the Resolve site before the show, and I was so glad to see that you had something about EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission rulings. Because one of the things that you don't often think about, if you're new to the world of infertility, is that the treatment of infertility can very often interfere with work. There are a lot of appointments, and clinics do a pretty good job of trying to make their appointments at a convenient time, very early in the morning, late at night, things like that. Not late at night, but after work and before work. So that, and they try to work with their patients to schedule during times that are that interfere with work less. But also, but the reality is there are aspects of treatment that do impact your work. So Barb, can you talk to us a little about some of the EEOC rulings that have an impact on people who have to take, and absences are what comes to mind, but there may be other things that the treatment of infertility would potentially impact your work.
Well, you know, I'm not as well versed on every EEOC ruling on this, but I think there's a couple of rules of thumb, and I will say Sean Tipton is a great legal mind too, and he's a great resource to try and figure out how to work a system in a good way.
Okay, Sean, you're up next.
But I would just say to people, look, infertility is a disease. You're going through medical treatment. This isn't a lifestyle choice. And if you feel discriminated against in your workplace because of your medical appointments and what you're what they are for, I would brush up on what the situation is in your particular state, the kind of employer you work for, and I would not stand for that. I would encourage people to speak up, and if they feel that they have been singled out, you know, we've heard of teachers at Catholic schools who are singled out. We had a woman at our advocacy day one year who worked for a printing company that printed materials for the Catholic diocese in her area. And she was posting on social media about coming to advocacy day, and they threatened her job with those posts of her in Washington, D.C. meeting with her legislators. So there's a lot of ways that this can impact your workplace, not just those missed appointments. So don't sell yourself short and say, well, you know, I can see where they might think that this is, they have some kind of claim. That is not the case. Sean?
So the issue is that the courts and the EEOC have found that not making accommodations for people who are in the midst of treatment violates part of the Americans with Disability Act and parts of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. So you're trying to get pregnant. Therefore, the question is, does the Pregnancy Discrimination Act apply? And generally, the precedent has been that, yes, in fact, it does. So, yeah, you have the right to get off work for your treatments, you know, and, you know, you should assert it. We filed as an amicus, a partner in one of the cases where a school teacher was dismissed because she was, it was a Catholic school employee, and we managed to help her win that settlement. So, you know, people will fight for you, but you have to be willing to start that, what can be quite a scary process.
No, it really can be. This is your job you're talking about. All right, Sean, what are some of ASRM's top targets for the next year in advocacy? Barb, you're going to be up next, so you be thinking.
Well, I mean, we've talked about some of the state access issues. We've talked about personhood. You know, I think at the federal level, a couple of things that we're going to be working on have to do with research policy and research funding. So we are always looking to make sure that our partners in the federal government, such as the National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control and the FDA, have the resources they need to do their work. So we are always working on that. There also have been some undue restrictions on the research process, again, stemming from oftentimes from the anti-choice community. So we're going to be making a run at some of those. You know, quite specifically, there's been a recent prohibition that stops the FDA from even evaluating gene editing technologies. And we think that's entirely the wrong way to go. We don't know that those technologies are going to work. They certainly aren't ready for clinical application yet. But we really need to be able to understand something before we make a decision that we're never going to do it.
And you think that will be coming up this year?
Yeah, it's going to be part of the appropriations process. So, you know, these are the laws that the government's passed to actually say, yes, this is what we're going to spend our money on. You know, the signing of the checks is the way I like to think about it. And you can put restrictions or policy riders in those bills. And so that's where that fight will take place.
Okay. And Barb, what are some of the main focuses for Resolve this year on the advocacy front?
Well, some of it is what we've talked about. California is just ramping up. They'll have a committee hearings in the month of April. Their legislative session goes until like August or something, July or August. So we have a couple of bills in the California state legislature that we're heavily advocating for, and we want to get a lot of progress this year. And then we want to really, there's a lot popping in Congress. Aaron Kramer, who works in Sean's office, has just been fielding calls and emails left and right from members of Congress. And, you know, with the House of Representatives controlled by Republicans, we have a very, very good chance of getting our big IVF for vets bill passed in this session. So that's 2019 and 2020. And we've been meeting with all the right people, and there's tremendous enthusiasm and for that. So I'm not saying it's going to pass in the Senate and become law, but, you know, we can make a lot of progress in the House of Representatives. I'm kind of excited about that because we've been sort of put off by what's been going on in Congress the last few years. And then surrogacy in New York, we have until June. We'd like to get that done. And then, Dawn, some of the other things that Resolve is going to be doing are more internally focused. It's building up our grassroots network, developing tools and resources for our Coverage at Work program, and just really expanding those programs and making sure we have the infrastructure and the tools and resources so that when we do sort of what I call blow those up, we have everything in place to support that. So those are the priorities that we're working on this year.
Excellent. And we thank you and ASRM for the work you guys do to help keep infertility available and legal and all the good things in infertility as well as surrogacy. And just one more shout out. We have Advocacy Day, everyone. If you're in the car, all you got to do is remember, really just May 16th, but you got to get there early on the 16th. So if you're coming in from out of town, you need to get in on the 15th. It's a lot of fun, and it does a lot of good. So keep in mind that you can also get information about advocacy issues at the ASRM.org website. So both places are where you need to go to get information about what you can do as somebody who has been impacted or who cares about those people who are infertile. As we always say, the information provided in this show is information that is the views of the guest and do not necessarily reflect those of the position of creating a family, our partners, or our underwriters. And also, this information provided is general advice. In this case, it really isn't applicable to this show since it's advocacy. Thank you all for listening today, and I will see you next week.